outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gene. The God Gene. The God Gene.
All right, this is going to be before the Super Bowl, isn't it?
This is Friday. Well, for some, most people don't listen to it that soon, so most people will hear it after the Super Bowl.
Yeah.
But it's Super Bowl weekend.
I'm really hoping that our home team wins. Hometown team, Thousand Oaks Rams. I know they call them Los Angeles, but they live here.
And
I
what will change if they do?
I will be super excited.
okay, well, that's worth it right there.
Right there. Everyone, ladies and gentlemen, times of
we want Brad to be
prayer and fasting, so I can be super excited.
That big scream you hear Sunday afternoon.
As goofy as this is, I just sort of feel like God has somehow put this little neighborhood in the spotlight. And I was so jazzed. I was really touched with the way that those guys responded, not just as some PR stunt, but I mean, it's like they live here. They were touched by this stuff too. And they decided to embrace that and saying, we're going to do something for the neighborhood in which we live. And I don't know. I kind of joined my heart. I went, there's something neat about them.
And you go to any pro team, whether it was Houston in the floods, Katrina in New Orleans, and they talk about the same thing, you know, millionaires who play football and have free time during off seasons and even during season, they do an awful lot. Most of them, you hear about the guys that beat up their wives or girlfriends and all that stuff, but
I mean,
most of them are great folks. And there'll be someone listening in Boston who's saying, Tom Brady to win.
I get all that. I just don't live there. So
I know.
I have a hometown bias.
I just wanted to point out how egocentric your desire was.
I know. It is selfish. And it's like, you know what? I'll be excited whatever their outcome is, because it's like I've had a chance to go like, you know what? There's something neat about a young coach. They do seem full of life. I have looked at this. This I thought was interesting. They are so focused on offense. They do have the worst defense, don't they?
The worst?
I think just about the worst defense in the stat-wise.
No, they got some great defensive players, but it doesn't always come together for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's just say they're not highly ranked.
Part of it's they're on the field so much because the offense scores in about 35 seconds when they hit the ball.
But what's so amazing is I sat there going like, wow, it did make me think the church is so oftentimes playing on the defense. I mean, no, we
this
are.
Is cute. No, I get your point.
And my spiritual little excitement went, you know what? I think as a team, I mean, the church is professional at having huddles. We don't run plays.
Wow. If you preach a sermon on this?
No, but I could.
You got all your sermon
we're not supposed to be
analogies.
We're not
all
supposed to be a
here.
Spectator sport. We're supposed to be participants. Supposed to get the jersey. And I'm supposed to get out there and throw me the ball.
You know,
I'm supposed to do something.
I realize I'm a little older than you, and I hate pulling rank on you at times like this.
Okay.
But, you know, one of the things I've learned in 65 years of rooting professional football.
Yes.
If God couldn't give a rip who wins what game, and nothing in the world changes because team A or team B wins.
I don't know that I agree, but that's all right.
Yeah, that's fine. But I'm just giving you experience of the wisdom of the ages.
And I got it. I heard the wisdom of the ages on the human level.
And I hope you're right, because I just don't want to see Tom Brady, and I know this kills all of our listenership in New England. I just don't want to see him win another Super Bowl.
He's had his turn. It's L.A.'s turn. That's what I think.
But I know this. If L.A. gets beat by 47 points, nothing in the world changes. Nothing about how God pours himself out.
No, but here's how I'd have a little different take than what you're doing. I think something that captures the world.
Let truth sink in.
No.
Let it sink in. Just let it come at.
It bounced off. I listened. It went doink. I didn't receive it.
I feel it coming closer to you right now.
I think when things are happening in the earth that capture the world's attention, I do pay attention in those moments, because I just go like, you know what? It would be just like God to not be absent from that. I don't – is God care about one team versus the other team? No. I mean, it's like, hello. During the Civil War, they had revivals on either side, and both sides were responding to God. I'm not pulling a God card on one side or the other, but I do think he speaks through things if we have ears to hear and eyes to see. And I oftentimes watch the main sporting events and just go like, Lord, are you saying anything? Is there something that you would be whispering to me through this. And I could ordain it and make it doctrine.
Good.
But I do enjoy it.
I can see that.
I know.
And I'm really thrilled for you.
I know. And the wisdom of the ages isn't as thrilled as I am. So that's all right.
Who are you calling the wisdom of the ages?
I didn't put a name to it.
I just felt the doink. I think it was clear what we were trying to say here, and offense is fully taken.
Okay. But I love you.
My dad would be the wisdom of the ages.
Okay.
I feel young in his presence.
That's good.
It's another
good
reason to go. So what else is going on?
I'm doing a Sunday evening service.
You did it last week.
They've asked me to just continue it.
Oh, you're doing it regularly, like?
Yeah. Which is, you know, I honestly have my ears. No, hopefully no one's listening. I've confessed my love-hate dynamic with it because it's like.
Oh, nobody from there is listening. Yeah, I was going to say, we don't do this, so nobody listens. you and I can just go to lunch, you know?
That's true.
We get food and a conversation.
Yeah.
Right now we're just getting conversation.
Yeah. I recognize the challenge of the institution just finding a place of freedom to let God kind of lead us. And the way in which we sit, the way we gather, all the different stuff around us does not make that very easy.
Mm, granted.
And you just go like, okay, why have we so inherited this form and are so locked and committed to it when it's really not that conducive for helping that happen?
Granted.
And so you just go like, okay, wow, I'll do as much as I can to lead them to where, you know, I feel like God is saying there's water, you know, let's go drink. And I just know that there's such a need to make things more relational. And I just recognize the way in which preaching so oftentimes happens, it is so non-relational unless you make it interactive.
Yeah.
And the audience has not been trained to expect any sort of interaction. It's like, you know, deer in truck headlights. They're not exactly sure what to do.
I'm taking notes here. I'm not thinking.
You know, and I just go like, okay, wow, that is not helpful to engaged saints.
Yeah, which is why I think Jesus didn't put a lot of it in that framework.
I know, but we still seem to miss that, or at least large sectors seem to still miss that.
Yeah, I mean, you're speaking at a fellowship on a regular Sunday night run here, I think, and I was last week at a fellowship in town, invited me to speak at a men's banquet, which they kind of opened up to the wives and God, the folks, because a lot of them have been reading He Loves Me at this fellowship. And so, yeah, I got a chance to hang out with them to be a guest speaker, which I go away from going, that's it. I spoke. I said some neat stuff because I say neat stuff. And then
you do. I remember. I've written things down.
And then that's it. There's no relationship growing from this. There's no.
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 See,
it wasn't bad. I mean, I had great comments after people said, oh my gosh, you opened a door into space for me that I've never contemplated, which basically was about being loved. And if you don't, then that's not
that shouldn't be as revolutionary as it is, but it is.
Well, it's not in terms of everybody knows it theologically, but I was talking about living loved, what it's like to wake up in the morning convinced that God loves you and what adventures that would take you on. And people going,
what?
Yeah, they at least got.
What I mean is this strange thing he's talking about.
Yeah, they at least got the fact that, hey, this may not be part of our normal deal. But I know from being in those environments, I know how quickly that's lost to Friday morning business stuff. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wake up the next morning and you're right back to the rigmarole. And I'll think about this again on Sunday when I'm in another service. And I know not everybody does that, but I think it's enough, like you say, it lulls people to sleep.
Well, the way in which we've gathered.
Yeah.
It's like we've made people passive.
And we were at tables, and I did have a lot of interaction. I just asked them, if someone were to tell you today that God loves you, and I mean has affection for you more than anybody else on this planet ever has for you, what would keep you from believing that? What's the biggest barrier?
Oh, nice. Good question.
Yeah. And it really, when we got into all the good stuff, we got into, you know, unanswered prayer and sin in my life, and I'm not doing as well as I should be doing, and all that stuff. So that God's still rating us on a performance-based system is kind of what emerges from all that, which is lovely, and people are seeing it. And talked about, you know, is being loved by God the starting line or the finishing line? That's kind of where. Because I used to think of it as a finishing line. When I'm good enough, when I'm committed enough, when my heart's God can love me freely.
Yeah.
Instead of, no, the starting line is when you begin to realize that you're loved. And the adventure starts there, where I get into stuff that hurts and things that are disappointing to me and disappointing inside a relationship with God I thought would protect me from this. And when I buy into, oh, but he loves me, so I'm misunderstanding what's going on here, that's where the adventure begins.
See, what's so crazy is once God kind of opens up that space and you start to see it, then when you cruise through the scriptures, you see it everywhere.
Yeah, you do.
Everywhere. You're not just a little bit. Yeah. I mean, I might be the only one that had this revelation that was a surprise to them. But I just sat there going like, wow, the Apostle Paul wrote 1 Corinthians 13.
That's right.
That is a correct statement.
That is true.
And you just go like, well, that's not what most people think about when you say the Apostle Paul. You don't think of a guy that is absolutely pickled about the supremacy of love. And I'm going like, well, but that's, if I read that and I looked at that, he's saying that's the greatest of it all. And we don't perceive Paul as that because he hasn't been taught to us as though that was true. And I'm going like, we've taught him wrong.
Oh, absolutely. Because Paul gives us the rules to go to.
I know.
And everybody go, well, Paul said, we got to do this. Paul said, we got to do that. Paul said.
Why do we get stuck there? And I know. And prefer that when it's love in the gas tank that makes any of this work.
Yeah. I use that scripture from Colossians where he's right before you get there, put off the old, put on the new, put down your anger, put down the body. He goes, therefore, as God's children, holy and dearly loved, abstain from immorality. So it's like, what? They got immorality going on? They got anger going on? And that's why I say it's the starting line, right? It's not the finishing line.
No,
it's the starting line. As God's children, holy. Now everything will make sense inside that reality, even your questions.
And nothing works outside of
it. Nothing works outside that reality. It doesn't.
And if it does, you only become a great Pharisee.
Ah. Yeah.
Which is not so wonderful.
You think?
I mean, at least to non-Pharisees, it's not so wonderful.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true. And for the Pharisees, it's not so wonderful, but they don't ever know it, particularly when they're a great Pharisee. Well, you're really good.
Well, yeah, if they have the good Baptist strength of will Pharisee. Yeah.
I got one of those writing about me, but I won't use that now because we just called him a Pharisee. So we'll slip it in later. I found this article, though. January 1st, I don't know how I ran across this, to be honest with you. It's from the Baptist News Global.
Nice! You're not on this? You don't have a subscription?
No, I don't. It's a website, I think. In any case, I was surprised, and this is not dissing on the Baptists. If you're like, oh, I got to listen to these guys now. This is actually a good article. I loved this when I read it. He said three words.
I know you sent it to me.
I did. He said three words for the church in 2019. So I go, well, what are the three words? And he goes, we were wrong. Those are the three words.
Nice.
Nobody starts January 1 with we were wrong. It's we're going to be better. But we were wrong.
The do better, try harder. Yes.
So he lists seven things here where Christians or Christianity as a whole has been wrong. Not everybody. Not necessarily everybody getting it wrong. But he said too much of Christianity is built upon absolute certainty and not enough on divine mystery.
Yeah.
Just as we've been trained to worship the Bible as the word of God more than Jesus as the divine word of God. That's
true.
I love that. That's true. I love that Baptists can say that. A Baptist says, we have been trained to worship the Bible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a truth.
More than Jesus who actually is.
Which is hard to repent of because it's not like the Bible's bad, but if it doesn't lead to a relationship with the word, it's not helpful.
So he says, number one, we were wrong about race.
Meaning?
The church has been unable to confess America's original sin, perhaps in part because it was a faith handed down without question from parents and grandparents.
Yeah, but that wouldn't be true of the whole side. That was one where I kind of went, yeah, there's been sides that have used that as their justification.
Yeah, but I'm going to use the church I grew up in, that tradition of conservative evangelical Christianity. There have been great Christians who fought against slavery and fought against racism. That's true. But as a whole, we've not been as
we've not led the charge.
Yeah, not only just on slavery, but today how do we make inroads against the impact of slavery on people's lives and push for racial equality?
Good point.
Yeah. And there and there may be people who's, well, we're committed to it, but done little. Affirmative action, well, Christianity basically opposed it without offering a better solution other than, well, people just need to work hard and get their way up. Like somebody said, I'm not saying the fact that you were white didn't mean your life wasn't tough, but one of the things it wasn't made tougher by was the color of your skin.
Right.
And I think that's a great statement.
And I think that we don't have a good grasp of our actual history. I didn't know my blindness to where some of the real angst that has been handed down and where the problems have been created that just have never changed. Where they got entrenched, they've just never gotten better. And that goes way back almost 100 years in a history that most of us would want to push under the rug and not be conversant with.
Yeah, it's past. This is the now. Now everybody has equal opportunity.
And so the challenge is someone that's not aware of that can hear the pain like they're getting punched in the face. And they're like, but I didn't punch you.
Right.
And it's like, that's not the issue. I get your response. I had it too.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not aware of the genuine pain and hurt that's not ever been very validated, that's been handed down, that really still hurts. And it isn't fair. And I don't know. There's no simple solution to any of that. That's the first thing we have to be able to say.
And a lot of the African Americans I know will say the same thing. There's not an easy answer.
I mean,
but the fact that white American Christianity will own the problem,
that would
be huge to say, yeah, we realize we have not been vocal enough. We've not looked for solutions enough. And partly because we've benefited from the inequity. That's one of the strange things about our culture, I think. I want justice unless I'm getting the other side of the unfairness. If the unfairness inures to my benefit,
then I think it's fine.
I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
But when the unfairness inures to my hurt, now
that's very hard to get past. Like if you're for the Saints, my excitement for the Rams is just illegitimate.
Right now it is, yeah.
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 You just go like, just illegitimate.
Yeah, they're just going, you're lucky. You got away with something because some official was what?
Asleep at the wheel.
Doing drugs?
Yeah. I had no idea. Look the other way. And I think one of the biggest challenges is it's not about, it's like if I can get past the sense of someone's hurt and their blame, it's not about that. It's about my caring enough to want to say, until this is helped for everybody, it's not okay.
Yeah.
I have to care until everybody that's harmed by something that's not weighted fairly or correctly and they really are damaged in the design.
Right.
I've got to care enough to say it's not about me and my sense of personal guilt or not guilt. That's where we get lost
in the
eddy.
Right.
And you're just going like, that's not the point. Can you sidestep that? And can we look at the problem together? And can I care enough to say, how can I be of help?
Yeah. Is there any, what can we reasonably do to right some of these wrongs and to make society a level, we can talk about the level playing field and the mere recognition that it's not, I think is very helpful.
Yeah.
And then to really then look for what solutions. But we could get stuck on any one of these for the whole show. So let me go to number two. We were wrong to protect sexual predators.
Oh, profoundly.
And not just the Catholic Church, which is important to know. I've got people I know and friends, almost any tradition you want to name, molested something by some guy. In fact, they're all getting exposed now in the media. You know how many of these guys, as youth directors, whatever, took a girl out, tried to make it just... We have not been vocal enough. I remember in the tradition I grew up in, we would never have called the cops.
You just deal with that privately.
Because that's a secular arm. But it's amazing the way we deal with it privately was always more about our public relations than it was the problem and fixing it. Number three, we were wrong about women. Biblical evidence against women as co-equals in church leadership is so scant, but the hand-me-down bias of the church is wrong.
I don't get that anymore. I think I maybe in the tradition I grew up, there wasn't, you know, female pastors.
Right.
But I look at it as like, really? God made both men and women in his image. But the female is just it's less than his image? Really? Don't we need both to fully reflect his image?
Wouldn't that be true? But I grew up in a tradition where, yeah, we didn't have women pastors. They were allowed to teach children and other women. They weren't allowed to teach men because of a couple of things Paul may or may not have said or how they applied. And yeah.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's just last night, my daughter Taylor just kind of raised the question like, Dad, what's the whole bit about women in ministry? It's like she's looking at me like, I don't understand. And I'm going like, awesome. Please don't try to understand. It's like that restraint. I look at most churches today and the bulk of the backbone is already women.
Yeah.
They're making the whole thing happen.
I've got a letter here too. I got this week. It break your heart. Cause it's not just about women in ministry. That's a big part of it. The other part of it is the woman subservience to a dominant abusive male.
Oh,
I mean, that's huge. And I'm going to read this letter someday because I'm not going to identify the person at all, but there's so much that she talks about in terms of disappointment and God and where was God when, and I grew up in this and it's because we've all had those same questions. That's what I love her letter. But so we were wrong about women. We disempowered them.
We still do.
In many ways, we still do. It's exactly right. So we were wrong about women. We were wrong about what it means to be pro-life. This will be a little more controversial. The church has erred both spiritually and politically by elevating the single issue of abortion as the definition of being pro-life. The result is an ugly kind of identity politics that shut down dialogue and harmed the gospel.
Yeah, I think it might be awesome if we understood I'm for whole life, not insurance.
Yeah.
You know? But I think that's what that's saying, and I think that's a legitimate criticism.
A good example is my friend Arnita. I had her on a couple of podcasts when you were running around the planet somewhere. She was invited to be on a board for a ministry having to do with a counseling thing, trying to get people not to have abortions kind of thing.
A crisis pregnancy thing.
Yeah, and her first question being asked about it was, how are we helping women who have had abortions? That would be my concern. If I'm going to be on the board, I'm all for helping women not have them.
Right.
What are we doing for women who have had them and are hurting?
Right.
And they wouldn't let her on the board.
Well, you should. Yeah. What?
Yeah, we don't do it. We don't know what that means. We're just trying to stop people from having them.
And they didn't recognize that as a good question?
They didn't recognize it as a worthy need to be dealt with.
Oh, goodness.
And I look at that. You know, there's pro-life march this weekend in Washington as we're taping this. And you see the faces, you see the signs, and you're going, you know, all that is intending to say, throw out Roe v. Wade, make it illegal. And I get the political point of view there, but if you're a woman who's had an abortion looking at that from the outside, you're not finding a lot of love or grace there. You're not. You're the enemy.
Not on the other side. Not in those visuals. I know several folks that do run crisis pregnancy centers and just listened on Sanctity of Life Sunday, a whole ministry that's geared just towards the people that have had abortions. And so yeah. I think I wouldn't want to paint with a broad brush too much, but I think that is the danger that when we champion a cause to the exclusion of the whole, we do run the risk of being greatly perceived as that if you're not right and you don't agree with us, you're the enemy and you're wrong.
Yeah, and I do think that's why. Not that there aren't exceptions to any of this, because there are. But to say, in general, the perception is, and he's right, it was identity politics. Because for a while, it was pro-abortion and anti-abortion.
Right.
Right? And that was the battle. That was the labels. And then one side goes with pro-life, and the other guys, I forget the other side now, not pro-abortion. No one's pro-abortion. Abortion's a bad answer, but it's for rights of women. To have, you know, so the language, these are all about language used to define.
It's language play.
Yeah, define a political position, and it doesn't embrace the Lord. What does it mean to be pro-life, womb to tomb, you know, the whole of life? And a lot of Christian groups have been more reticent here to help along that way. And I think part of it is not just we don't want to help. It's that we don't trust government to help. And that's where I line up on a lot of these things.
Yeah, I don't really trust government to help either. I think most of our nasty ills in society have perhaps started with the best of intentions, but they end up, they don't recognize the things that get spawned.
Yeah. I mean, I just like healthcare for me. Healthcare is, I don't know how you tell someone, we can't fix what's wrong with you because you can't pay for it. But we're going to let you suffer or die at a young age simply because you don't have the money or the insurance or the whatever. I do think it ought to be something that everyone can access. At the same time, I don't see government being the provider. They can't even do it with veterans. So, which we all agree veterans should have all the health care they need, but we can't run that system. In part because we can't fire people from government work who are incompetent to do their job. Yeah. So, you know, I don't know what the answer to it is, but I don't think the answer is you can't have health care. I don't think that's the answer. That's part of being pro-life too. And I don't know how we get around it, because my hope is not in the government to resolve these things. It just isn't.
Yeah, I know. And so oftentimes I think people, out of their backlash of going, I'm so tired of people gaming the system.
Yeah.
That creates all this graft, corruption, and all this other stuff. You just go like, okay, yeah. I don't know what system you can create that someone with ill motives isn't going to try to game. I don't know. I have no hope.
But both from the inside and the outside.
Yes.
Yeah, both sides. Yeah.
To me, it's the utter failure of systems going like, I don't know a single one that's impervious to that. And I don't know. I don't even know how to stop it.
Which is why people, I think, on the progressive side of things, they're willing to say, yeah, we're going to have a government program. We're going to try and do the maximum amount of good. We do realize a certain amount of resource is going to be wasted to corruption and dishonesty. But the other option is to leave people uncovered. And that's the two sides of the argument. There's too much corruption. We've got to do a better job too. Yeah, there is corruption, but for the good that it does, and I know many, many people in it, whether it's healthcare, welfare, have been incredibly helped, lives transformed because there was government aid at a time when they had nothing else.
Sure.
So there's good stories as well. But yeah, I'm one of those that's saying I'd be willing to trade a little more government availability in things if we had more accountability between government workers.
You know, what's so frustrating is that when you place it like that, there's a reasonableness that comes screaming to the forefront that you're just like, wait a minute, really? We couldn't find a way between the two of us if the common welfare, as opposed to mine versus yours,
right,
was if I was really trying to promote the common welfare, there are ways to find better than we have solutions. I don't know of any perfect ones, but we now run the real risk of, in the name of truth, my version of it.
Yeah.
I'm going to stand firm on principle. And what it seems like to those outside of that firm principle is you got zero compassion. And I'm going like, well, I'd love to be able to say, no, that's not true. But I end up going like, well, that's what seems to be missing from the dialogue that might bring us together. Because the thing I can agree on, I'm not a liberal, not a progressive. Furthest thing from it. But I do find a wonderful sense of agreement going like, I'm going to give them the benefit of the doubt that there really is some true compassion there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of thinking, I should be majoring in that. That ought to come screaming out of the things I believe as one of the most important things. But it doesn't, not from the side that I stand on or represent. Yeah. I'm just going like, that's where this thing is really broken down, where you're going like, why do we not find a harmony and a joy in finding solutions around that?
Yeah, I've got a friend in the whole healthcare debate of the Obamacare thing, and he's further left than I am on many things politically. But he said to someone who was, you know, and he's a conservative Christian, so he's getting that from that side of people. But I remember one of the things he said, you know, the reason why I'm pro Obamacare. And the Christian he was talking to says, why? He says, God, I don't trust you. He said, what do you mean you don't trust me? He said, I don't trust you to care for the poor. So if you're not going to care for them, if you're not going to pay, how many hospital bills have you paid for somebody that was poor in this neighborhood? What responsibility have you taken to care for your fellow person? Have you taken any?
Yeah.
Okay, that's pretty persuasive there. No, it really is.
Because I think that's the darn problem, is that government has picked up something that I don't believe it was ever commanded to carry. The caring for the poor, that's the job of neighbors and communities. That's the job of people that could actually be there and know the details. As opposed to some monolithic principle that you're just going like, it's a system that can be gamed.
Yeah. And every system is.
And you just go like.
I couldn't even invent a church system when I had the opportunity to do it that couldn't be gamed.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, that's my biggest frustration. You're just like, I don't know how to do this and it not be warpable.
Because systems don't protect anything. Any system is as good or as bad as the people involved in it.
Yeah.
I do.
We default to systems.
We do. People do.
We like to think, oh, so they got it. So I don't have to.
That's exactly how it works.
And because of that, that's why this thing goes rotten.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's, well, now that we got that, what's the next one?
Man, we're almost all done here. Number five, we were wrong to exclude people from God's grace because of their sexual orientation or gender identity. Perhaps the first step that the church could take is to listen to its own sons and daughters and to believe them when they say they did not choose their sexual orientation.
Yeah. That one is sticky. No, I mean...
I like what he says. He's not saying sexual orientation is okay with God if you, you know...
I know.
He's not saying that. He's just saying... If it's not a choice, if it falls under some of that sin that's addictive and there from birth.
And we're damaged.
And the creation is, not just they are, the creation is. We all have things we struggle with. And if we could have given grace, which is not permission and it's not condoning, and it's grace is just you are loved in spite of the fact that you have things going on. And not totally define a person's personhood based on their sexual orientation. You're more than that.
Absolutely.
All of us.
I mean, I sort of feel like, again, it's like we fail to have a redemptive healing conversation because we have become issues oriented and truth oriented that just says, because I would know a ton of people that are going like, oh, I'm squeamish about what you just said because it sounds like you're saying it's okay.
Right.
And they're going like, but I got clear words that say it's not. And they don't know how to go like, well, could we not set that aside as if it's not true, but could we actually talk about the reality of how do I deal with a hurting person? Because there are things in my life that I've got, you know, clear letters that would say what I'm doing is wrong. And it's like, that doesn't remove me from the very conversation with the God who can change and heal and love me.
And what is grace for if it's not for what's broken in us?
Yeah.
So
I just think somewhere the challenge is I think that times hear people saying, no, you need to accept that this isn't a broken thing. This is just me. And I'm going like, okay, I don't want to call a person broken. I get that. I get how that can be so destructive to their capacity to even have a conversation.
Right.
And you just go like, somewhere in this, love does have to prevail, and it doesn't contradict truth.
Right.
That isn't that hard.
And truth doesn't negate love.
That's right.
It works both ways. And yeah, I think in our fear about sexual orientation, are wanting it to be in the closet, are wanting to shame people away from doing it, or at least letting us know they're doing it. Yeah, we want to shame you into a closet because we're more comfortable if we don't know what's going on than if we do.
But I think that closet door is ripped off. I don't think we have that reality quite like that anymore.
Well, not the reality to the same degree, but I tell you, you've got a lot of stuff hidden in the dark because people know that if others around them knew, they'd be treated differently.
Yeah, I mean,
they would.
When I look at this, do we got one more there?
I have two more there.
Okay. I look at the whole list and I just end up going like, okay, why is it so difficult? I mean, I get the power of what this guy is saying is like the three words for 2019 needs to sort of begin with we were wrong. Why is that so hard for the church? Because it's not because we're saved because we're right, but we come across that. We come across as though I think that's what's so distasteful about the church is we're so busy trying to declare us right. And I'm going like, yeah, but if we really look closer at your life, maybe not so much.
But I think a lot of evangelical Christianity from about late 1800s into the 1900s, now 2000s, I do think a lot of it's been built on we're right, we know we're right, you're wrong. It really is built on this false confidence.
Salvation is found in that.
Yeah, and that we don't have questions. We're not
associated
involved,
with what's
we're
right.
We're not involved in the mystery. We're right. That's why I think when I started Bridge Builders and I would go to places and do more, I never did much interactive teaching when I was a pastor.
Uh-huh.
When I started doing Bridge Builders, and that's the only way you can do stuff among educators today. It's got to be very interactive. So I was fine. And I was finding them, man, just really engaged in the conversation. Then I would go try and do that in a more religious setting. And like you said,
does it go so good?
People don't want to interact. Why? Because there's a right answer. I'm not sure what it is. Somebody's going to tell me eventually. And all I want to look like I want to look like I know the right answer. And
we're so absolutely terrified about error. And it's like, well, I'm sorry. I don't know the person on the planet that doesn't have some.
No, absolutely. But I think the idea of presenting the illusion that I'm always right is really important to religiously embedded people.
And that's what the godly thing is.
Yeah.
And I just go like, okay.
Because God's always right, and I know him. I'm going to always be right, too, which is crazy. Because
well, it just is so goofy to me going like, we're erecting something we don't even adhere to in our own lives.
Exactly.
And then we want people to believe us in spite of blatant hypocrisy that we don't want to admit because – my salvation's at risk.
But we don't even have compassion for ourselves where we fail.
Not in that whole deal.
In the whole religious strain of things. You don't. You don't have compassion.
I got to shame myself into obedience.
I shame myself. I hide it. I try and pretend to be better than I am. If I'm authentic with people, people aren't going to like me. Yeah, so I think being right and trying to prevent the illusion of always being right, that's really key to this whole thing. So being able to look at somebody, if you sit down with somebody who just is angry because the church has been wrong on homosexuality, and if you just look at them and say, you know, we were wrong. We were wrong the way we treated you. We were wrong what we conveyed to you, and I'm really, really sorry for any way I've contributed to that.
It
would move the conversation.
Yeah.
I've never been in a situation where I start with, I think I was wrong here, that isn't always good. But it's still hard to say. I only want to be right.
I'm not looking for error. I'm not looking to embrace error, and I'm not looking to say error is fantastic. But I think you have to be honest. We all have it.
Yep. Six. Just we get 6, 7 real quick. We were wrong to measure the kingdom of God in numbers more than souls.
Yes.
Yeah. I think that's the whole church growth movement took the church, I think, in a horrible direction. We're just counting bodies on Sunday morning. And in our case, we counted them multiple times because – If you came to the early service and then went to a Sunday school, you got counted twice that morning.
Twofer.
Yeah, because you were in two. Yeah, you were there at two different times. Yeah, it's bizarre. Anyway,
double
the last one was we were wrong to put our hope in politics. Wow. You know what I love about that? I was reading Isaiah this morning, and he talks about at one point, he's got a prophecy over Egypt. That's how God's coming to destroy Egypt for what it's done. And he says, I'm going to set your sons and daughters against themselves. I'm going to tear you apart from the inside with vitriol and anger. I'm going, is that what's going on in America? That's my first thought.
No.
Because I'm working on this book about the language of healing and can we move conversations more like we've been talking about in this podcast. Can we find some common ground to reach out to each other? Not you're all right and I'm all wrong or you're all wrong and I'm all right, but can we find some middle ground to still hold to our core beliefs, not compromise those? And I'm right because I think we can do better. And then my thought was in reading that, am I fighting against God with a book like that? Has God sent this influence on the nation that we blame social media, we blame this, we blame that? Is the vitriol and anger part of God's doing? And if it is, and I haven't concluded that it is, but I'm thinking, my gosh, that's exactly what he was going to do to Egypt. I'm going to tear you apart from the inside. And could that be happening to this country? It is happening. Is it God behind it or not? I don't have an answer for that.
You know, I think what's so difficult.
But I find it intriguing.
I've been writing a screenplay looking at the whole life of Frederick Douglass, and it's like the whole Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just going like, okay, you could try to reduce that to its simplicity. And a lot of history has done that. And the more I dig into this, the more you just go like, okay, this, if you really want to learn meaningful lessons and not repeat the same stuff, there's nothing really simple here. There's some truth things that you're just going like, sometimes you have to be able to fight against evil and be courageous enough to fight it and win. But you got to know that that's not just your preference. You got to know when that's the Lord. I was amazed when Lincoln in the second inaugural address is looking at the same thing going like, ooh, I think this is a judgment on us all. And he's saying that in light of knowing both sides are praying to the same God. There's revivals happening on both sides of this war.
There's stories told when the lines were so close together. One side starts their nightly service to ring the troops up for battle tomorrow, singing "A Mighty Fortress Is Our God." And the other side would sing the second verse louder to drown out them so they could sing the third verse louder. And they're all appealing to the same God.
Yeah.
Thinking they're right and the other side is wrong, and we get to kill them in the name of the God we think we're serving. That's sad.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Anyway, we're past time, but maybe just learning we are wrong. I am wrong. It's a great thing to say now and then.
Well, I think if society, if we could all find some agreement that chances are we're all able to say that, we might actually be able to have a helpful discussion that could bring us to something that would be more productive than where we're at.
Yeah, maybe not just for January 1, 2019, but just about maybe, every day maybe, we take breath.
Maybe.
Yeah.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.